Well, good evening. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. And once again, joining me in studio to move this program right along, Mr. Dwight Schultz. And Dwight, I don't know which persona we need tonight. I wanted to say maybe Lieutenant Barclay, but when I looked at the subject matter, maybe Captain Murdoch would be more in line.
Well, I can only say that it is a great pleasure to be speeding along at the threshold of light through satellite dishes all across Mother Continent America and up and down the coasts, left coast that we're on, the right coast on the other side, and all the ships at sea. Yes, it's a great pleasure.
Well, this is going to be an awesome program. The whole gang is here once again tonight. We have Vicky online at 10 o'clock for the media update. Renee's in here to give out the phone numbers and keep everybody else in line. Jeff's over in the control booth making sure that Darren pushes all the right buttons, so I guess we're on track. You know, just like UFO Magazine, UFOs Tonight attempts to get to the very bottom of the existing database. And of all the parts of this fascinating, mysterious, and almost overwhelming subject that we continually attempt to dig and pick at is the root of it all, the government information. And, you know, we've done a number of shows in the past where we've gone after documents, where we've had researchers in here with documents that they've secured from Freedom of Information, documents that have surfaced after many years. But yet there is one team of researchers that I continually push when people come to me and they say, what books should we read to get a working knowledge of this subject? What books do you recommend that would really be legitimate books that show a lot of research that go for the root cause? And one book, Dwight, that I always recommend, always, is this one that I'm holding right here that nobody out there in radio land can see, but Clear Intent, by Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood. You know, we had Barry Greenwood on here about a year ago, or no, I guess about a year and a half ago. We have never had his co-author, Larry Fawcett, on the program. But just this past week, when I was down in Orlando for the Disney thing, down at Disney World, I ran into Larry Fawcett. Now, Larry, for you people out there that may not know him, is a police officer, a lieutenant. He was a police officer for many years in the state of Connecticut. I was unaware of it until I bumped into him. He just retired, and he and his wife have moved down to Florida, where he's continuing on in his investigations. And as a matter of fact, he's in the process right now of writing another book, which we'll be talking to him more about that. But what I want to do before we really get rolling and I bring Larry on the phone, I want to read something from Clear Intent. And for you people out there that may not be familiar with the book, and it has been reissued under a new title, The UFO Cover-Up, I want to read one of the sections here. And we're going to be going through various parts of this book during the course of the evening. But this book, ladies and gentlemen, is taken strictly from military records. Think that UFOs is a crackpot subject. Do you think that many of the people in it are crackpots? Well, get a load of this. Now, this particular section that I'm going to be reading is from one of the chapters titled Echoes from the Past. And it's about a military intercept that happened back in the early 50s between an Air Force interceptor jet, an F-89, and an unidentified flying object. Now, this will give you an idea of where this particular book is coming from. F-89C is in Charlie, serial number 51-5853A, assigned to the 433rd Fighter Interceptor Squadron, Truax Field, Wisconsin, was reported missing over Lake Superior at approximately 2000 hours Eastern Standard Time on 23 November 1953. The aircraft was scrambled from Kinross Air Force Base, Michigan, to participate in an active air defense mission. The aircraft and aircrew had not been located as of 1 January 1954. On the 23rd of November 1953, F-89C, serial number 51-58-53A, was scrambled by Naples Ground Control Intercept to intercept and identify an unknown aircraft flying over Lake Superior. The interceptor, ladies and gentlemen, became airborne from Kinross at 1,822 hours Eastern Standard Time. The original radar control of the aircraft was maintained by Naples GCI, or Ground Control, and at 1,841 hours Eastern Standard Time, control was transferred to another GCI station called Pillow GCI. The aircraft was flying at 30,000 feet at this time, and at 1,847 hours Eastern Time, at the request of Pillow, the aircraft descended to 7,000 feet to begin its interception. The location of the aircraft was then approximately 150 miles northeast from Kinross and over northern Lake Superior. At 1,851 hours, the interceptor pilot was requested to turn to a heading of 20 degrees to the cutoff vector. After the turn was completed, the pilot was advised the UFO was at 11 o'clock, approximately 10 miles distant. Radar returns from the aircraft were seen to merge on Pillow's radar scope. The radar return from the other aircraft indicated it was continuing on its original flight plan, while the return from the F-89 disappeared from the GCI station's radar scope. And there's another paragraph that I'm not going to go into, but this aircraft and the two-man crew was never located, neither the men or the jet airplane. The jet airplane was seen on the radar scope to be merged and absorbed into the UFO. The UFO left the scope. The aircraft and the air crew to this day have never been found. Now, when the Air Force was queried on this, they tried to say that this UFO was in fact a Canadian aircraft. The Canadians vehemently denied it. The basis of the entire thing? Unknown. Nobody's talking. And this isn't the only airplane and crew that's ever disappeared out of radar scopes and off the air into basically the Twilight Zone. Well, we're going to bring Larry Fawcett onto the air. Larry, it's a real pleasure having you here. Out of all the UFO researchers that I know, I've got to tell you, you've got my respect as much as anybody, and you guys did one heck of a job with this book. Are you there?
Don, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, I was afraid I pushed the wrong button again, Larry.
No, you got me. I'm here. Thank you very much, and it's nice being on your show.
Well, Clear Intent, now it's called the UFO Cover-Up. It's still available.
Yes.
What caused you and Barry to attack the problem from the aspect that you did? You went strictly for the military records.
That's correct.
Did you decide that this was the best way to show the reality of the subject?
Well, yes. We felt that possibly the answer lied within the government's own files. After seeing the data that was coming out from other researchers that had started to delve into the government, the old keyhole drive into the government records, we felt that let's go to the heart of the matter, that the government should know what's going on. And, of course, as you know, after the quest was over, indeed, they proved the reality of the phenomenon.
Your background as a police officer, as a senior police officer and an investigator, did you find that this was handy into trying to complete what you were doing? Did you find that it was much handier being an actual investigator from the standpoint of a police officer that made your job easier, your task?
Yes, I believe it was. It was much easier for me to interview witnesses, and when we were, say, like probing into the incidences or the overflights over the Strategic Air Command bases in 1975, it was very easy for me to turn out those individuals that were involved in the incidents, especially if they were police.
Well, you and I have talked many times, Larry, about that aspect of it, and as it turns out, there are a tremendous amount of police officers around the country that are aware that there's a very real phenomenon here, aren't there?
That's correct.
Why do you think that more of them haven't gone on record about it?
Well, It all stems back to the early years when the government was debunking quite heavily. If you reported a UFO, even police, they would discredit you. Some police lost their jobs over reporting UFOs. So there was that pressure to bear, and due to that fact, a lot of cops didn't want to touch it. When Barry and I began querying into the government, and I in Connecticut had sent a lot of letters around to the various state police barracks and police departments in the state, asking them not to deep six any UFO reports that were coming in. And of course, you know what deep six meant. When they tell you they'd file it, it used to go into the garbage pails. When I started that down in there, I got a lot of cooperation from not only the police departments and the state police, but I made very many contacts in the FBI also.
The FBI? Were they willing to discuss this with you rationally?
Yeah, some of the individuals that I work with personally on the job would.
The FBI, as a rule, though, going all the way back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover, and for many years, Hoover denied the FBI even kept any files that had anything to do with the subject of UFOs. How did that square with the agents that you spoke to?
Well, the agents that I spoke to, let's say I cultivated them, if you will.
Right.
We worked on some federal cases together in my career in law enforcement, and some of them I became very good friends with. And, of course, information flowed back and forth on certain things, and I was able to glean certain information from certain agents, let's say. These agents that did tell me things did not like the policy that the United States Air Force was following on the secrecy of this thing.
Did they think that it was an Air Force-inspired policy or perhaps another agency?
No, they think it came from higher up.
And that could be anywhere.
In government, yeah.
Larry, we're right now at the quarter. I want to stop very briefly and have Renee give out the phone numbers. And incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to be taking any phone calls yet. I'll give you the high sign when we're going to start. But get yourself a pencil, a piece of paper to mark this information down because you're going to want to know it. I'll tell you when we're going to start taking phone calls, and then you'll have it handy. So stand by. And we are back with my guest, Mr. Larry Fawcett, who along with Barry Greenwood wrote one of the definitive books on UFO research and government involvement, originally called Clear Intent. Now it is called The UFO Cover-Up. And where can people find this book today, Larry?
Well, and go to their local bookstores, and if they don't find it on the shelves, ask them for it, because it's still in print.
Okay, very good. And who's publishing it now?
Simon & Schuster Fireside.
Okay. Your book here, which I can't give it enough accolades. I think it's fantastic. There were a number of cases in there that were truly eye-opening when I first read them. What do you consider the most important events in this entire book? And would it be the nuclear facility overflights?
Yeah, you know I always talk to you about that. Yeah, that's my favorite. I believe that the October-November 1975 overflights were the most spectacular events in UFO history, if you want to say, because here in the two-month period, there was so much going on, not only at these SAC installations, but the towns and cities around them. You had spin-offs of cattle mutilations, unmarked black helicopter harassments. There was so much going on, not only with the government, but the sheriff's departments that were around these bases. And I was very fortunate due to the fact that I had the law enforcement background, that it was easily for me to break down doors and get information. You know what I'm talking about.
Right.
From fellow officers. I'm not talking about physically breaking down doors.
Well, sure, Larry. Why don't you go ahead and give an overview on this? Now, we've hinted around about these cases, but we've never really talked at length about what was happening during October, November 1975 in the Air Force bases that were involved. Why don't you go ahead and start giving the rundown on that?
Okay, sure. The incidents actually started at Loring Air Force Base up in Maine, and that was around October 27th in 1975. Around 7:43 in the evening, the 42nd Police staff was on duty at the bomb dump, which, by the way, SAC bomb dump at Loring was a nuclear bomb dump. And the sergeant who was on duty at the time in the bomb dump began to see lights coming in low over the northern perimeter of the base there. He estimated around 300 feet. And he thought at first it was a plane that he was seeing because of the navigational lights that were showing to him, which were red with a white strobe on the craft. At the same time, up in the tower, another staff sergeant, I think his name was Sampley, I'm trying to remember it now off the top of my head, was on duty at the tower and also observed this aircraft on the tower radar. About that time, it was 10 to 13 miles east of the base, and numerous attempts were made by radio, not only military but civilian, to try to make contact with this plane to tell him that he started to fly over restricted air corridors of the base. After trying all communication bands, they weren't able to or successfully contact this craft, which began to circle at one point and came within 300 yards of the nuclear weapons storage area at approximately about 150 feet.
Now, I'm surprised that by this time there was not a violent response from the Air Force.
Well, there was a violent response. what happened, you have to go into the sequence of events that occurred there that was so spectacular. As this plane penetrated the base, the commander of the 42nd Bomb Wing there was notified, and the base was immediately put on a Security Option 3 alert, which brought the base up to a major alert status. The guards around the base at one point claimed that the object had touched down and then took off again. I was very lucky in the Loring case because I used to play baseball for the police department team, and there was a gentleman that played along with me by the name of Steve Eichner. And Eichner had heard me talking about the information that we had recovered from the government about the Loring incident and came forward to me to tell him that he was one of the people involved in that fracas there at Loring at that time. He was working on a launch control truck. His rank was a sergeant. He saw this thing coming over the base perimeter and over the runways. Him and the other people who were working in a launch control truck, they jumped in the truck and headed towards the object, which at this time was down into the nuclear weapons storage area. Now, they rode in a road right alongside of, which I believe it was Oklahoma Road, that runs parallel and down into the nuclear weapons storage dump there. As they turned the corner to get into the dump, bang, they ran smack into this thing, which was hovering right in front of them. they stopped the car, and the description that was given by Eichner and the other people that I talked to, and I was able to get to them from through Steve, because he had the names and addresses of these people. Once they left the military, this thing looked like a stretched out football, and it looked like there was heat waves shimmering in front of it, as he described to me when he gave me his testimony, and it was exhibiting an orange color, and he estimated that the object was about 4 car lengths in size. Now, this thing just hung there, and as he told me, the best way to describe this, he said to me at the time, was it was looking like you see waves of heat rising off the desert floor, and this is what was in front of this object, and all the colors were blending together when this was occurring.
Well, what time of day was this?
This was nighttime.
Okay.
It was around 7:30, 8 o'clock when the first penetration started.
So in October, this would have been very dark.
Right. Well, if you know anything about the weapons storage area, that's lit up pretty good. When they're seeing this thing, all of a sudden the base became alive. They can hear sirens, and they can see the blue lights of the SP vehicles coming down the runway and heading towards the nuclear weapons storage area. They figured they'd better get out of there because, first of all, they were in a restricted place. They had no business there. Only people with the right security can get into there because, as I said before, there were nuclear weapons stored there. So they drove the turnaround the truck, and they got out of there. The SPs that were passing them going into the weapon storage area didn't even bother them at all. They were more interested in what was hovering into the weapon storage area there. Once they got in, and Eichner drove the truck back out, and they went back over to the launch area where they were before and watched all this commotion going on. Eventually, from the documents that we obtained, we found out that once the SPs got in there, the object shut its lights out and completely disappeared. It was not seen again that night. Nobody knows where it went. It just, once the lights went out, nobody could see it anymore.
Now, you're talking about the internal object lights.
Right.
Not the base lights.
No, not the base lights.
Now, do you know if anybody...
I know what you're going to ask. Yes, none of the electricity was bothered with. If you know, there was no interruption in electric power into the bomb dump there.
Did anybody fire on this?
Not that we could find out. Eichner did not hear any gunshots, and there was no indication in the government records that were released to us at the time that there was any gunfire there.
Isn't that unusual, though?
Sure is. It sure is. After that incident that night, like I told you before, the base was brought up to a Security Option 3 alert, which is a very, very high alert. Also, priority messages were sent to the National Command Center in Washington, D.C., and to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force and to the Air Force Forward Operation Division at Fort Ritchie, Maryland. Also, SAC headquarters and the 9th Air Force and the 44th Division. I mean, there was a whole load of people that they were shooting memos to over this incident that night, advising them that an unknown had penetrated the base perimeter and had been into the nuclear weapon storage area.
Mr. Fawcett, this is Dwight Schultz.
Dwight.
I can't say enough about your book either. Everything that Don said goes for me, and I remember reading this, I think it was back in 85 it was published?
The book came out in 1984.
84. Yeah. I read it in 85.
Yeah,
and it was
currently in three languages now.
And it opened my eyes back then. Recently, the Soviet developments, the Soviets have also chronicled events very similar. When I don't know if you are familiar with the recent the KGB files that have been opened up.
Right, I've been seeing some of the work.
It really rang some bells in my head from the accounts in your book. Very similar, that the objects flew over nuclear
weapons
areas, and I just said, you know, here they were coming out full and completely saying yes, this did happen.
Right.
But it was chronicled many, you know, in your book. It seems like it's the same thing.
Right. Almost the same thing. Sure.
Almost the same.
Which shows that it was not only happening to us, but was happening
there, and
right,
it was a confirmation to
sure.
me.
Sure.
You know that. That this is real, that this did occur.
Yes, you're right. Mm. You're right, Dwight. Mm. Like I said in the beginning of the program, once we began going through these documents, just the October-November incidents alone, not only what was happening on the bases and the documents and the memos and the messages that were flying back and forth through the chain of command there, but what was occurring outside the base at the same time, because not only the military was reporting these overflights, the civilians around the bases, the police departments around the bases were seeing them, and there was so much going on at that two-month or three-month period. Actually, the events spread out further than October and November 1975. They went all the way up into December and January of the following year.
Well, Larry, the Air Force tried to explain these sightings away as some type of civilian unidentified helicopter.
That's correct.
Coming into the base. Now, we all know that this is absolutely ludicrous. Didn't anybody in the media challenge them on this?
Yes, they sure did. Bob Pratt, who, by the way, at that time was working for the Inquirer. I know when you hear the choir, everybody cringes, but, you know, they're the largest selling newspaper in the world, if you want to call it a newspaper. More people read that than the New York Times.
Well, you know, they've even been credited with having the most accurate up-to-date reporting available on the O.J. Simpson thing.
In the New York Times.
Yeah,
the New York Times. In fact, the New York Times got into a lot of trouble because they were literally quoting the National Enquirer.
Right. Well, anyway, on October 31st, 1977, Bob sent a series of questions to the Secretary of the Air Force about the Loring incidents, specifically because of the helicopter responses that the government was giving out. He sent a series of questions and requested answers for them. The questions were basically, were the objects ever identified or traced? And the answer that came back was no, the overflights were not identified as helicopters. and unsuccessful attempts were made to trace the sighted craft. I have to jump as I'm reading these, Don, because at the time of the penetrations and lowering, the radars, once these things would disappear and then they would reappear in another location and eventually took off, their heading was towards Brunswick, Canada, where our radar units would lose them up in that area. Anyway, Pratt asked another question. Was it ever definitely established that the helicopters, that they were helicopters, or was it an assumption based on the sound and the light coloring on the aircraft? The response came back from the Secretary of the Air Force, no, the helicopter assumption was based on the sound and light perceptions of the witnesses. Bob then asked them, were there any markings at all on the aircraft? And the answer, of course, came back, no, no markings were identified. Did they appear to be any known type of helicopter? And the answer was the type of aircraft could not be identified due to the limited visibility.
Larry, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Keep that thought. We've got to take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, more with my very special guest this evening, Mr. Larry Fawcett, who along with Barry Greenwood wrote the definitive book on UFO government involvement. The name of the book, The UFO Cover-Up, formerly Clear Intent. My name is Don Ecker, the show, UFOs Tonight. You've been listening right here to the Cable Radio Network. Joining me in studio to help move this program along, Mr. Dwight Schultz, and we will be back after this. The big question. Does the government admit that it has studied the UFO situation, and have they been forthcoming? Well, there's an organization out there called CAS, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, which the title is David and Goliath, the CAS, C-A-U-S, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy Battle. An example of the difficulty that CAS would experience in dealing with government agencies surfaced in clashes with NASA and the State Department. On April the 26th, 1978, Miles Wagner of NASA's Public Information Service branch responded to a CAS request for information relating to a NASA report. The report was titled UFO Study Considerations and was previously said by NASA to have been prepared in cooperation with, you guessed it, the Central Intelligence Agency. Miles Wagner did an about-face, stating there were no formal meetings or any correspondence with the CIA. No explanation was ever offered for the earlier statements. And now, coming back to join us, Mr. Larry Fawcett. Larry.
Yes.
I guess the government has been less than forthcoming about their UFO situation.
Oh, yes. The government was well aware of what was going on and was lying to the American people from the go, from the beginning, as you know. The 75 overflights was but it was so spectacular that they tried to keep them events away from the public. When news media queried the base as to what was going on, they were told, don't worry about it, they were only isolated incidences, to keep them away from the other bases and the other penetrations that were happening at that time. I did work with a reporter when we put that section together on the Loring thing, and his name was Dean Rhodes, and he covered the Bangor, for the Bangor paper up there, and he covered the Loring overflights. And when he queried the base, he was getting the same thing, because people were calling him, telling him that there were aircraft flying off the base, and there was a high alert going on at the base because the people could hear the sirens going off and all the lights around the base and so forth, and the fighters were taking off because there were pursuits during that three-day period.
Jet interceptor pursuits?
Yes, interceptor pursuits where they chased these things up into the Canadian provinces and lost them. Interesting, we were in the Loring thing there. The government federalized the National Guard helicopter. The idea was at the time that they would put this chopper on alert, let it stay on their runway, and when these intruders would show up, whoever they were, they would launch this this chopper to find out if they could identify them.
That doesn't make sense.
No.
Why would they put a National Guard helicopter on alert when their own interceptors, things like the F-4, mm-hmm. Phantom Jet, and so forth, couldn't catch them? What good would a helicopter do? Was it even armed?
No, it wasn't armed. It had on board a couple of OSI agents, a Maine State Police officer, and a Canadian Royal Mounted Policeman, and some of the SPs from the base. The reason for the Canadian law enforcement group was that if they had to go into Canada and say they downed this thing, and maybe it was drug runners, they were speculating a lot of things at that time, that our police, of course, had no jurisdiction there, so therefore the Canadian Mounties would have taken over. Guards began, when this thing was on the runway waiting for the calls to come in the next night, sure enough, they began happening. The helicopter was launched. It was vectored in from ground personnel to the object. The chopper got to within 100 feet of the object. The pilot was reporting he wasn't seeing anything, but yet the guards on the ground was telling him it was right in front of you. It's right in front of you. You got to see it. And he would stay there for a few minutes, turn his searchlight on. He couldn't see anything. But yet again, the ground personnel was saying, it's right there. You've got to see it.
Like the light was being bent around it.
Right. I don't know. But anyway, we talked to the guards from the weapon storage areas and those that had reported the chopper and witnessed this event here. And the pilot, Bernard Pullen, I spent 3 days talking to him about this event. As soon as Pullen would leave because he wasn't seeing anything and there would be another report coming in from another part of the base and he would leave that area, as soon as he left, the lights would come back on this thing and people were seeing it again.
It's almost like they were playing cat and mouse.
Yes, there was.
Well, how did you happen to initially hear about this? I would think that the U.S. Air Force would have gone to great lengths to keep this situation secret.
I actually, and here again, I'm talking about the National Enquirer, began to read stories in there about this, and also Steve Eckner, who lived in my community, began telling me about these events.
So as a result, you were able to start following up. Was the Air Force forthcoming with you about this?
No. When many researchers, and there were many researchers involved in the 1975 overflights, not only Barry and I. There was Bob Todd from COAS, Peter Gersten, our attorney. Many people had input into the luring to the overflights of 1975. When they began filing Freedom of Information Act requests on these things, and the documents we started to get back showed, indeed, there was something really spectacular going on there, Don.
Well, that was not the bottom line, though. I mean,
no.
What they found out about one of the nuclear weapons was even more amazing.
That's right. You're talking about the Malmstrom incident.
Yes.
Over the missile silos.
Why don't you go ahead and lay that information out?
Okay, basically what happened after the luring intrusions that were 3 days, it began breaking out at other bases such as Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, which had 20 launch control facilities which housed Minuteman missile underground silos. The sites are all alphabetically coded. Specific incident, November 7, 1975, the Kilo 7 site in the Judith Gap region. Now, I was handed this thing actually on a platter because of a good friend of mine, Linda Howe, who does the Mute investigations, actually leaked, not leaked this, but turned me on to this case. And I was able to talk to the helicopter pilot that brought in, I'll get to that point. Anyway, on November 7, 75, a remote electronic triggering device in the silo flashed an alarm indicating that something was violating the site security upstairs. Now, usually, the launch control facility is about 100 feet underground. The procedure when this occurs is they call out to security and tell them that the site's being compromised. And the procedure is that they usually send a SAT team out to the site to see what was going. 9 times out of 10, when these things happen and the SAT team would arise, they would find that there was rabbits or some other type of animal that was setting off the alerts upstairs. There were no cameras, per se, in and around the launch control facilities at the 7 site to show the guys in the launch control what was going on upstairs. So the SAT team responded, and it consisted of 4 to 6 men. That started in towards the site. They drove down the highway and then turned onto a dirt road that led into the Kilo 7 site. About a mile away, they began seeing this orange glowing object over the area. It was hovering. as they closed into about a half a mile of it, they could see that this object was tremendous in size. In fact, some of the guards I talked to told me they would bet it was about a football field in size. The whole object was illuminating the missile silo site itself. When they reported in that they were seeing this thing, the SAT team was ordered to proceed on into the site itself. They got to within a half a mile of the site, and from what they were seeing, Don, they were so intimidated that they refused the orders to go into the site itself. They wouldn't go in. This object eventually started to rise up, and as it was, NORAD, because we filed some, when I say we, I say the people in cause, began filing on NORAD, and we were able to turn some documents to show that once the object began to rise at about 1,000 feet, NORAD picked it up on radar.
And so they confirmed it.
Right. And they carried this object all the way up into infinity and lost it once their sensors, you know.
Did they confirm the size?
One of the documents, I'll get to that. I was going to tell you about that. One of the documents at another site, they picked up and they describe it as a humongous thing. Anyway, two F-106s were launched from Great Falls, Montana and headed towards the K-7 site. The UFO continued to rise, and around 200,000 feet, it disappeared from the NORAD sensing devices. The F-106s never got a visual on the UFO. The SAT team was directed back to the base and directed to go directly to the hospital where all the members were psychologically tested. None of the team members could actually identify what they had seen as an aircraft or anything they had seen before. They had obviously had been through a very traumatic experience. Targeting teams. Now, here's where Linda Howe's information came to us and was very useful. She turned me on to the helicopter pilot that brought in the targeting teams. And computer specialists were brought into the missile site itself to check out the missile. And specifically, the computer in the warhead that targets the missile. Amazingly, the computer showed that the tape that targets these missiles had mysteriously changed targeting numbers. The next day, they took the reentry vehicle, was taken from the silo and brought back to the base, and eventually the whole missile was changed.
With absolutely no explanation.
No explanation at all, other than they must have been getting more than faulty readings, you know, down in the launch control facility after this event had taken place.
Well, you know, Larry, we're going to have to take another quick break here in just a moment, but let me ask you this. What have the skeptics said about this when you've presented this type of information to them?
Well, once the book came out, our lead skeptic, as you know, Phil Klass.
Yes, we know him very well.
Yeah, must have been taking a bath and reading his newspapers, reading the book at the time, and said, aha, I know what this was, you know. And
he was just on here a couple of weeks ago.
Right, he attacked Eichner, saying that he was nothing more than a peon, he wasn't an officer, and, you know, so on and so forth. When this story came out and the whole overflight business came out, myself, Peter Gersten, Eichner had given testimony up in the press building in Washington, D.C., because at the time, Gersten was fighting NSA for the documentation that we'll talk about in a little while. But Eichner was right on. He agreed. He produced every document that I asked for to show that he had been there. He turned me on to the other people he was working with at the launch control truck, all verified his stories, and so did the government documents verify his story.
And there we are. And we're gonna have to take a quick break. When we come back, Dwight, you wanted to say something. But let me put you on hold, Larry, and we'll be right back after this. We are back. Dwight, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted
something.
To say, to go back again, that now that the Soviets have, I mean, the encounter that was reported was almost identical to this one, save the fact that weapon had, in fact, the indications were it had been armed, which was even more frightening. But now that I think, authenticates this, I think that it lends an incredible amount of credence to this. I wonder if there has been any sharing of information that could be fingered between the Soviets and the U.S. One would think that this kind of, and you know that their intelligence, the intelligence forces knew that this was going on in both countries. I wonder if there was any communication between the two governments. Was this happening to you? Yeah, it's happening to me, Rusky, you know?
Well, we never found any indications of that in the government documents, but I wouldn't be surprised because...
Well, today, though, what I'm saying is I wonder if something has come out. I mean, I know George Knapp has gone over there to the Soviet Union. I mean, if their generals are coming out and saying, yes, this happened, and if the... Those enlisted men and military men who were in those silos are coming out and describing it. It seems that maybe somewhere there's, you know, some paper floating around somewhere that could be located. Yeah.
Right. Maybe Knapp can uncover that. The interesting thing here in the whole overflights of Loring, that the government itself said, no, we couldn't identify this thing. It was not a helicopter, you know? And it really scared them because they put the whole tier on a very, very high alert at that time.
Well, you know, Larry, a number of weeks ago, a pioneer in the UFO field passed away, Leonard Springfield. Leonard was at the forefront of research for many, many years. And, you know, a number of years ago, I talked to Len about the activities he was involved in back in the 1950s, and one of the things that he told me that stuck in my mind up to this day was the fact that the United States military, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Navy, everybody that had an air wing were losing airplanes by the gross back in the 50s, encountering these UFOs. That's a very little known fact, but it's nonetheless, it's there. The military was losing aircraft and air crews routinely in the 50s and all the way up to the 60s. In your book, there was a particular part here that fascinated me on an incident that would seem to be a part of an ongoing process where these unidentified objects have a great curiosity over areas with nuclear power plants, nuclear weapons, and so forth. It's the incident that happened in 1969 in North Carolina around the Atomic Energy Commission research facility at Oak Ridge.
Yeah, right.
Why don't you go into that information? Because this is another case where it has fantastic implications and it's virtually unknown.
Well, what had happened is, as you know, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, is the place where we do a lot of nuclear work down there. And what basically occurred was an unknown began showing up over that area for several days. They were seeing things. They were picking it up on radar. It was generating a lot of documents that something was going on there. If I remember the story correctly, I believe there was even a scramble of aircraft for that thing that occurred over there.
The two F-4s.
Right. I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head because it's so long ago that we went into that. But anyway, that incident there generated quite a few documents. As you know, the literature and the documents from the government files talks about not only the penetrations in the early years over Oak Ridge, Tennessee, but also the very beginning when we were testing the Manhattan Project. There were the green fireball mysteries that were occurring down in that area. There were penetrations over super-sensitive military installations there that were dealing with...
Right, but in this particular case with the F-4s, evidently this unidentified slapped both F-4s down, and their crews ended up basically disappearing into a military psychiatric unit, never to return.
Right, and when we tried to get documentation on that, we came up with a negative, you know, like the incident never happened.
Right.
In fact, Maccabee was able to turn quite a bit of information on the Oak Ridge, Tennessee thing.
Bruce Maccabee.
Bruce.
Well,
right.
Now let me ask you this: you say there was the documentation came up negative on that,
right?
But where,
in other words, they were saying no, this incident didn't happen.
This incident didn't happen. But what Don is
there was a logical explanation.
I'm
sorry to interrupt.
Oh no, that's all right. I'm asking Don. Where does the information come for the original story?
It came from an airman who originally had allegedly been privy to this incident. He, who was a highly trained radar operator, was sent to Vietnam, where he was killed yeah. on the fence line.
Yeah.
Now, what a highly trained radar technician would have been doing out
up on
the perimeter
fence
defense.
Line. You're right.
You know.
It was like they almost sent him there to keep him quiet.
Hmm. Which in itself, if there's any truth to that, that in itself should make for a major expose.
Well, you know, that's happened before in UFOs, in the phenomena itself, where if you remember back in the old APRO days when they had an informant, a master sergeant, I believe, that had an encounter. In fact, he had an abduction. When he began talking about it, the government shipped him right out. Nobody had access to him after that.
Well, that also happened after Roswell.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's basically where it first started happening with this subject. There was another case in here that, if not showing hostile action, at least certainly showed the unidentified's ability to defend themselves. It happened over the communist nation state of Cuba in March of 1967, which you guys broke for the first time in your book, Larry. What do you think about this Cuban MiG-21 incident?
Well, we were just talking about this last week when I saw you, or a couple of days ago on the phone. The Cuban incident thing is one of my ones I like very much, too, because there was paperwork generated on that. As you know, a Cuban specialist, an interpreter for NSA, was down at a listening post off the coast of Florida, began picking up transmissions between Cuban air control and their planes. I guess they were seeing an object over Cuban territory there, scrambled a couple of MiGs after it, and both MiGs went down. When this interpreter passed this message out to a UFO researcher, specifically Stan Freeman, and Freeman began to inquire in this, and with the assistance of Bob Todd, when they began inquiring into the government about this, they were being stonewalled, you know, saying this thing never happened, in the beginning. And then the next thing you know, when Todd said, okay, if this didn't happen, can I write to the Cuban government and ask them, if I can, the CIA told him, go ahead. So about 10 days after that, Todd had a visit by the FBI, as you well know, and they intimidated him over the thing, telling him that he was violating the Treason Act of the United States government, and they scared the heck out of him, trying to keep him away from attempting to write to Cuba at all or to gain information. Since 1969, all the way up until 2 months ago, I've been filing Freedom of Information Act requests on the Central Intelligence Agency, specifically on the Cuban case, and I always get the same thing, that they can neither confirm or deny the incident, and it's exempt due to presidential exemptions, blah, 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 you know, what they usually hand out.
Well, you know, you guys were also some of the first people to break the story on NASA's federal regulations, which would allow them, at the discretion of the director, to detain, examine, decontaminate people and things that have come in direct or indirect contact with any extraterrestrial life.
That's right.
Without benefit of a lawyer, a jury, or anything else, they can basically lock you away.
Yep.
How did you guys happen to find out about that? There was a tremendous amount of controversy over these rules. Many people were not aware that they even existed.
Right. Barry found it, actually. Barry Greenwood found the code. Which I believe was 14 CFR 1211, which talks about that very thing that you talked about.
14 CFR 1211, yeah.
Right. Barry, he was the one that found that document. When we asked if that thing is still in effect, they said, yes, it is.
So theoretically, if UFOs are extraterrestrial, anybody who sees one, approaches one, touches the object, is even abducted, may be liable for a $5,000 fine and a year in prison if they don't submit to indeterminate detention.
That's correct.
That's pretty awesome.
Yes, sure is. What they were, when we began inquiring into that, they said, no, we're not talking about you finding UFO pieces per se. We're talking about rocks and things we bring back. If you come in contact with that, you're going to be quarantined.
But
the directive don't say that.
Yeah.
No, the directive doesn't say that.
If
they went by that criteria, anybody that picks up a meteorite could be liable for that, couldn't
right.
they? Because it doesn't originate on this planet.
That's right. And if you inquire into that today, that's still in effect, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I know it is. Well, you know, we're almost at the top of the hour where we've got to take another station break. When we come back, we'll start taking some phone calls in the second hour. But is there anything quickly that you have about a minute and a half that you wanted to touch upon before we go to the break?
Well, as you know, the big thing now that's going on is Roswell, and I believe rightly so. There's so many pros and cons to what's going on. You know, there's those that are for it, those that are against it. My personal feelings on Roswell, and it doesn't reflect my co-author's feelings either, is that Roswell was a real event. It wasn't Project Mogul. And I believe the drive of all investigators in the field who's ever looking into this thing should be towards finding the pieces that are floating around. Because if you have the piece, you have the evidence you need to prove the reality of this phenomenon.
So what you're basically saying is you believe that some of those GIs that were present on the site during this incident kept pieces and parts of that craft.
That's correct. In fact, I know it.
Do you think that could be the smoking gun?
I believe so. Of course, you say, like you said to me the other day, what if the material turns out to be 100% aluminum or tin or, you know, hypothetically, whatever.
Right.
That was manufactured here, okay? I would say there are ways to tell if this thing has traveled, you know.
Well, not manufactured here, Larry. What I was saying was, suppose it's an element we can identify.
Right.
Does that negate that it may have come from this alleged spacecraft?
Well, sure. Look at the elements we brought back from other planets, from Moon specifically. They find the same elements there as they find here on the Earth.
Exactly.
You know?
Okay, we are at the top of the hour. Let me put you on hold. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more with my special guest this evening, Mr. Larry Fawcett. My name is Don Ecker. Joining me in studio, Dwight Schultz. The name of the program, UFOs Tonight, and you are listening to the Cable Radio Network.